Where do the midterms stand? Is the economy sputtering out? And what does the FBI raid against pro-life activists portend? We'll discuss all this more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry. I'm joined, as always, by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, the Sage of Authenticity Woods, Jim Garrity, and Jack Butler. You are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. Our sponsors this episode are NetChoice, Ball & Branch Sheets, and Segura. More about all of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. And now, before we do anything else, a quick word from our first sponsor, NetChoice, a trade organization dedicated to free expression and free enterprise online. Americans expect our tech companies to keep us safe, secure, and private online. We use tools like app stores with confidence because we can trust companies to filter out as many scams and unsecure apps as possible. But a bill moving through Congress, the Open App Markets Act, would force companies to allow apps that don't meet their security standards to be hosted in their app stores, leaving Americans exposed, confused, and vulnerable. American tech companies spend a lot of money and time on research, security protocols, and tools to minimize online scams and criminal activity from bad actors. Don't let Congress make us vulnerable online. Tell your senator to vote no on the Open App Markets Act. So, Jim Garrity, we are getting closer to the midterms here. You have a lot of polling. Some of it shows the generic ballot tightening up or maybe a little favorable to the Democrats. There was an ABC News, Washington Post poll, though, that showed among likely voters a 5-point advantage for Republicans. That's pretty big in the context of the past experience where Republicans can be tied and still have big midterms. And notably, this poll had Biden right back down under 40% at 39. What do you make of it?
The first thing that I'm looking at when I see generic ballot numbers these days is a question of, is this survey of likely voters or registered voters? If you look at the Real Clear Politics average right now, at least last time I checked before we started taping, Democrats were barely ahead by 0.3 percentage point. And yet Republicans had lead in, like, I want to say like 4 of the 6 most recent that go into that average. There were 2 polls that had Democrats up by 5, which looks pretty recent, pretty good for them, except those were of registered voters. And they were conducted in around mid-September. And I'm kind of left asking the question, hey, guys, are you ever going to get around to putting on a likely voter screen on these samples? Or are we just going to assume that 100%?
I'm checking your work here. And yeah, lo and behold, I'm looking at this page on Real Clear. So you had Harvard-Harris registered voters. This is 2 weeks ago or so. Democrats plus 2. Trafalgar, likely voters, Republican plus 6. New York Times, Siena, and Fox News, both registered. Democrats up 2 and 3. Then you have a tie in the NBC News registered voters. A couple more registered voters, Democrats up 5. And then likely voters, Rasmussen, Republicans plus 2. Likely voters, Emerson, tie. Likely voters, CBS News tracker, battleground tracker, Republicans plus 1. And this ABC News poll we're just discussing, likely, the likely screen has a Republican plus 5. So you're absolutely right, if you had any doubt.
That should be your blanket assumption, Rich. So you look at that, and I'm kind of left like, you know, by the way, in my home state of Virginia, and I think at least three other states, early voting has started. And in the coming days, more and more states will be doing this. So we're not talking about registered voters or likely voters. Some of these people who answer the phone are voters. Like, they've already cast their ballot. So the idea that you're walking around and just telling us what the numbers look like amongst registered voters doesn't seem all that helpful. And then the second thing, which I think is, I don't want to overstate this, but when you're looking at this, it's basically asking people across the country. We all know that a whole bunch of districts are not competitive at all. You got your R plus 20 districts and your D plus 39 districts in, you know, places like San Francisco. So it's not really that surprising. It can only give you a general sense. There have been some surveys that have tried to narrow it down to the swing districts, and they have Republicans doing, at least in the last, you know, last number I saw, considerably better.
Yeah, big.
So that points to me, okay, well, you know, if Democrats are doing great, but it's all in these blue districts, well, it doesn't really help them any. And if Republicans are doing better in the purple districts, then you should see some fairly significant Republican victories in the House. The one cautionary note that I would say, and eventually I'll give you the more specific numbers, remember, Republicans are starting from a very high floor here. So there just isn't that many low-hanging fruit for them to pick in this particular cycle.
So Jack Butler, obviously a big theme this cycle has been poor candidate choice by Republicans. You have New Hampshire that appears just to have been totally kicked away by the GOP. You have Arizona where you have a lot of poor choices, and it looks like Blake Masters potentially is disappearing beneath the waves, although Carrie Lake, who is much more out there than Blake Masters, is running almost even in her gubernatorial race there, maybe a byproduct of her being on TV for so long and being so well known. And then you have Pennsylvania, where Oz has picked up ground, but you still have some polls with Fetterman ahead. And then you have Mastriano appears to be flaming out, a real election truther. So where are you on all this?
Well, my basic take hasn't changed all that much, which is that it's looking like the Republican chances for taking back the House are good and have been good and remain good. And Republican chances for taking back the Senate are up in the air. And as you said, when it comes to the Senate, this is depending a lot on candidate selection. I think the Arizona thing is interesting because after that primary happened, the assumption was that Carrie Lake would be the sort of holding Blake Masters back. But if anything, it's the opposite, which is an amusing development especially for all of the sort of Masters stands out there. But it turns out that, I mean, it may, as you said, just come down to television experience. It is just really going to show. Well, let's go to New Hampshire as an example. Brian Bolduc, probably another example of a race that was plausible for Republicans, a plausible contention just being needlessly endangered by poor candidate selection. Bolduc notably sort of flipped on his election truther stuff. How sincere that is, it's impossible to look into people's heart, but. You know, it'd be a much easier and much more plausible case to make if you had someone who didn't believe that stuff in the first place. But yeah, it's just going to show. And the difference is that I think in these House races, they're not quite as nationalized, or they're not quite. It's easier to
not as yoke yourself.
Right. It's easier to yoke yourself to a national trend as opposed to having to like have basically a mini presidential race in these states. And so that I think explains part of the disparity and why I think that disparity is likely to obtain through election day. I am told that you're going to ask for specifics in a second, so I will hold off on that. But that's sort of where I see the sense of things going.
So, Charlie, what's your view in terms of the narrative we had for a while about the red wave trickling out? It seems as though it's, I wouldn't say picking up, but the narrative that it was trickling out might have been overdone.
Yeah, I think there was an overcorrection. And probably there was a little too much hype before that, which required some, albeit not as much, overcorrection as we got. There's also the change in circumstances. So I wrote this morning about the president's attempt to take a victory lap when there has been no victory. I do not buy the idea that everything is fine and that the economy is about to rebound. I am more of a pessimist. But the circumstances in June, July, maybe even early August were so bad that Biden's approval rating and the fate of the Democratic Party dropped precipitously, and a small improvement in the economy, in gas prices in particular, has mitigated that. So I think what people are looking for, because they know from the last 30 years that midterms tend to follow the pendulum, is one or the other. It has to be, it seems, in headlines, either a red wave or blue wave. But I think we are not going to get anything close to a blue wave. And I think the size of the red wave was overstated. And what we're going to get, especially given the high starting point in the House, is a good night for Republicans. One theory I have about state elections is that, yes, in Arizona, I'm sure, Carrie Lake's television experience and fame has something to do with it. But that the states that are run by Republicans have a much more obvious, intuitive, and I think powerful case to make than do Republicans at the federal level. Republicans at the federal level, and I believe we'll talk about this a bit later in the podcast, don't seem to stand for a great deal. Now, it's important not to be Joe Biden. It's important not to be Democrats. It's important to be a respite from unified control of the government. But the federal Republican Party is a bit of a mess. The state-level Republican parties are not. What is at stake in Florida? We just saw it. We just lived through it the last 2.5 years. The same is true in Georgia. The same is true in Arizona. I don't think voters have much reason to complain about the state-level Arizona Republican Party as it has been exemplified in the legislature and in Doug Ducey. People do intuit that the issues that are in play there are different. And I wonder whether some of what we're seeing in this difference is attributable to that.
So, Jim, good segue to go to the release of the Kevin McCarthy agenda. And I tip my hat to McCarthy people for realizing it would be good to have an agenda, which has not been a high priority, as Charles alludes to, among national Republicans. In fact, they didn't even have a platform in 2020, but this is a little vague and gauzy.
I'm okay with it being a little vague and gauzy. And by the way, this is one of the rare areas where I'm willing to give Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell some grief. He really didn't want Republicans to be running on anything resembling a unified agenda. And I think that's wrong. I think you should, you know, while you obviously allow people to run on different issues and different races and emphasize the ones that they think are most important for their campaign and most resonant with the state or district that they're living in, this is politics 101. I think you'd do much better if you give some people something to vote for. And I think there's a really kind of a cowardice is harsh, but basically to say, you know, you want to build a mandate. You want people to say, yes, we affirmatively want Republicans because they're going to do X, Y, and Z. They're going to investigate the origin of COVID. You knew that one was like, you know, that's the targeting Jim Garrity aspect of this blueprint. Crime, reducing reliance on foreign. This is all generic, positive. There's no real surprises in there. Get rid of the 87,000 IRS agents. You know, this gives some people some fodder for ads. I don't think there's any easy shots for Democrats in here. To the average real genuine swing voter or stuff like that. So I think it's fine. And I'm not all that upset that it's not a, you know, truly detailed, specific. It's not, you're not giving us the text of the legislation right here and now.
I got to really admire the timing of your contractor there, Jim, who just waits till you start speaking to do the hammering.
He does.
The agenda is being built as he's speaking.
Jack, I'm building the American economy.
Yes, thank you, Jim, for doing that. So I think that this is a tricky thing. The case that Senator McConnell makes that it's sort of at a disadvantage to present a concrete sort of list of as in the form of an agenda because it gives your opponents something to grab onto and it reduces your freedom of maneuvering. I get that. I mean, you've all then made a couple of issues back and NR made the most erudite case against that. But what I think this plan, which basically amounts to we are for good things against bad things, very, very powerful agenda, amounts to is sort of the pro and con, the promise and the peril of the kind of anti-leftism as the most potent force within conservatism, which I think it is right now. And this is what has motivated a lot of conservative victories in the past couple of years. And it's in that sense, and in other senses, it's a good and salutary reaction sort of emerging from the body politic. The problem with it, and this sort of reflects broader issues within conservatism, is that it doesn't really articulate a concrete stance on a lot of things other than just being against whatever the left is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as long as there's this sort of abiding dissent within the right about what it actually stands for and wants, it'll be hard to actually produce an agenda or a platform that will get everyone to agree with and that will actually be able to translate into like a practical plan for government. Beyond merely obstruction and resistance, both of which I'm in favor of. I mean, Biden is and the Democrats are doing bad things, but it'll be hard to move beyond that. And I don't know, going through this agenda, if it really presents a concrete plan for that. And if it doesn't, then I kind of, it's sort of an open question to me what the point of it was.
Yeah, I think McConnell is wrong about this. I mean, I understand why he always takes this posture, but it just strikes me as just good small d Democratic hygiene to tell the voters what you want to do. You know, they deserve to know. And if you choose wisely and you support good policy, it shouldn't kill you by any means. And it also gives you something to hang on to when you actually win the majority, if you do. So you're not just looking, staring down and mumbling and looking at shoes when you're trying to determine what you actually want to do once you have power with that. Exit question to you, Charlie Cook. Let's start getting ourselves on the record where we think this election is going to come out. How many pickups will Republicans get in the House and how many, if any, in the Senate?
One net in the Senate. 25 in the House.
Okay, I'm writing these down because we're going to return to this.
I just have a request. Last time I completely nailed the presidential election and then you said that I didn't.
I remember there's good reason for that. It was depending on which way you looked at it. I think you maybe got more states right, but Jim came closer to the electoral count number.
From a certain point of view.
Yeah, so Jim Garrity.
I was going to put it 20 to 30 House seats, but it sounds like you want something a little more specific. Yeah. So to vary it up, I will be a little more optimistic than Charlie and say 28 House seats. I could say a comfortable margin, but not the landslide that some folks were talking about earlier this year. I find it very easy each time I go through the Senate map to get the Republicans to 51 seats. Getting to 52, 53, you need some of those states to fall their way. Pennsylvania doesn't look quite as bad as it did. Arizona still looks terrible. So 51-49 is still looking like the safest landing spot from how I see it.
Jack?
20 House seats, Senate balance does not change. I'm keeping with what I said the last time you asked me this question.
Wow. So basically that's sort of a red trickle.
Oh, that'd be a huge disappointment.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be pretty underwhelming.
Wait, 20 seats would be enough, but like, yeah, people would be talking about how many seats
if the Senate,
Republicans
yeah,
if
the Senate were not to change at all, there would be grinding of teeth and wailing, and people would be cast into the outer darkness.
Yeah, so I admire your willingness to be different because I'm pretty much aligned with everyone else, especially with Jim. I mean, my numbers are exactly the same. One pickup in the Senate. One net pickup, Republicans control the Senate, and 28 House seats. With that, let's go to Charlie Cook for our Ball and Branch read.
Did you know that thread count is a myth? Because it doesn't matter how many threads your sheets have if they're not the best threads possible. And do you know who has the best threads possible? Ball and Branch, which uses the best 100% organic cotton threads on earth for a superior softness and a better night's sleep. Ball and Branch's sheets aren't just buttery, breathable, and impossibly soft to start. They get softer with every wash, which means over time, you like your sheets more, not less. Now, I sleep on Ball and Branch sheets, and because I've slept on Ball and Branch sheets for a while, my sheets have got better over time. My sleep's got better over time, which is good because I spend quite a lot of time asleep, as we all do. In fact, when the sheets are changed, we look for the label, which you're not allowed to remove, and choose those over all of the others, just like three presidents. I don't know which ones, But the Bolenbranch sheets are made with threads so luxurious that they're beloved by three U.S. presidents who presumably had more need for sleep than I do. The signature hem sheets, those are the ones that I have, are a bestseller for a reason. They feel buttery to the touch. They're super breathable, so they're perfect for every season, or as is the case in Florida, summer. They have over 10,000 stellar reviews. They come in 9 neutral colors in all sizes, from twin up to California King. And you'll immediately feel the difference of their iconic signature sheets if you get some, because they're 100% free from toxins, which means no pesticides, formaldehyde, or other harsh chemicals. They fit the deepest of mattresses. They're labeled with top and bottom tags, so making your bed is easier than ever. So easy, I can do it. And best of all, Bolenbranch will give you a 30-night risk-free trial with free shipping and returns on all orders, although, of course, you will not need to return them. If you want to get your own set of Bolenbranch sheets, which you absolutely should, and if you don't want to pay full price, you are in the right place, because we have 15% off your first set of sheets if you use the promo code EDITORS15. To take advantage of that, go to bollandbranch.com. That's bollandbranch.com. And when you check out, put in the promo code EDITORS15 in the little box.
Thanks so much, Charlie. So why is it, by the way, that you can't remove those tags?
I don't know. I think it's in the Bible.
Well, it's allegedly a crime for which the FBI will pursue you. So we'll get into that in a few minutes, perhaps.
So, Jim Garrity, let's go to you first, because you wrote your jolt about this today. We're recording a day early on Monday, because we have a big NRI event coming up later this week in California at the Reagan Library, honoring Larry Kudlow with the Buckley Prize. But you wrote today about how all these flashing red lights with regard to the economy, layoffs, although the job market has been surprisingly strong, and still the unemployment number is in the threes, but all sorts of other warning signs as well. At the same time, inflation is persistent and the Fed looks determined to continue pumping the brakes. What should we make of it?
Well, Rich, you mentioned the NRI event coming up this week. Right around a year ago, when we were meeting in Dallas, the illustrious and always cheerful Kevin Hassett talked about the economy, and he made it sound really dark and depressing, and he said we could be headed towards a recession. And I remember, wow, that sounds really, you know, Kevin Hassett is usually this very cheery, you know, things are looking up kind of guy. And lo and behold, since then, we have had 2 consecutive quarters of lower shrinkage in the GDP. A lot of people argue, well, it's not technically a recession. It doesn't really count as a recession. The unemployment's still low, et cetera. This all started for today's jolt when somebody I know who works in supply chain issues said, man, you know, every one of my clients is trying to get skinny, meaning trying to reduce costs, including layoffs. I think the next jobs report is going to be terrible, because everybody, you know, every company I'm dealing with is kind of battening down the hatches and expecting some rough times ahead. So, you know, maybe it's recency bias, where once you start looking for something, you start seeing it. But then I saw, you know, there are significant layoffs at Boeing, at The Gap, at Google, at Facebook, at hospital chains across the country are starting to lay off people. Maybe that's some sort of post-COVID effect. But once you start looking for it, wow, you can find a lot of layoffs. And I don't know if this means this month's jobs number is going to be significantly worse, but it does indicate that this kind of vindicates this notion that a lot of companies are unnerved about what the future holds and not accounting on things. And this is all separate from the absolutely, you know, hellacious roller coaster that the stock market has been. So I kind of dug into this, and besides all the usual issues going on with the economy, there's 2 that are jumping out. One is energy prices. And you might be saying, oh, you know, gas prices are low, so things are better. First of all, keep in mind, the decline in gas prices stopped. And they are currently at the price per gallon is not, it's right now about 367. It used to be stopped at 367, now it's at 372. Now, I don't know what you're used to paying in your neck of the woods, but that's not cheap for me, right? You know, $2 to $3 is the usual range here in Northern Virginia. So 372, I mean, that's better than it was back in, you know, mid-June, but that's not great. And oh, by the way, every single indicator is indicating that electricity prices are going to be very high this coming winter. Home heating prices are going to be very high this winter, whether you're using natural gas or whether you're using oil. So I strongly suspect that home heating prices and electricity prices are going to be to the winter, this coming winter, as gasoline prices were this summer. Just the topic that's on everybody's mind, the topic that you find yourself talking about, even without somebody bringing it up. Like, oh my God, can you believe these prices? Ah, you know, all on top of inflation numbers that really haven't gotten that much better. For Democrats, it may be good news. The, you know, real impact of high home heating prices will kick in after Election Day. But I don't think that's going to be particularly good news for anybody. And then the kind of the last aspect is, if you feel like there's a shortage of housing in this country, and this is one of those topics that periodically burbles up and then kind of fades away for a while, it's there. There's a really fascinating article in the Wall Street Journal that basically said that due to lousy zoning laws and a variety of other bad policies, you have these boom towns, Austin, Tampa, Atlanta, all through the Sun Belt, but there just isn't enough land that is already ready to go that you can put in roads and, you know, sewer lines, water lines, electricity, all that kind of stuff. And so it's just kind of these two exacerbating factors of people having to pay a lot for rents and mortgages, and on top of that, having to pay a lot for energy costs. None of that is helping. All that creates a great sense of financial squeeze. And I would say keep an eye on layoffs starting to add up month by month.
So, Jack, the stock market has been way down. As we're recording today, it's down again. It's below 30,000, below the level when Joe Biden took office. How alarmed are you about the economy?
Well, so a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about political midterm predictions. I sort of joked that, but not really joked, that it can sometimes feel like a kind of pagan ritual, like divining these weird auguries from random metrics, seemingly random metrics. I feel that way a little bit with the economy, even though there's all these numbers flying at you. They are also very concrete and real numbers. Like these show up in people's wallets and people's stock portfolios, etc. I'm a little worried, but the person who should be most worried in just raw political terms is Joe Biden, and then more broadly the Democratic Party, because I'm with Charlie in thinking that we sort of overinvest our politicians in their ability to like affect the economy almost to like a priest king level. He's sort of like making it rain, like ancient pagan deity stuff. I don't know why I'm so into this pagan stuff today. It's not reflective of my actual religious views. But the way that we have tied this up, that Biden and Democrats and Republicans do this too, love to take credit when the economy is going well. Well, the flip side of that is when it doesn't go well, even if it's not necessarily your fault. And I think in this case, there's a lot of ways in which Democrats and Biden are to blame for these things. Then you're going to get blamed. And that's a way in which, if I may dip back into the previous topic just a little bit, the midterm forecasts could change dramatically. I mean, if there are bad economic indicators leading up to Election Day, that will change things seriously in the Republicans' direction. I mean, there's not going to be much that you can do to stop people from registering discontent with the status quo if the status quo is just, by all these metrics we have, considerably worsening. So, yes, I'm a little worried, but in just raw political terms, if you are able to heartlessly divorce people's genuine suffering from political trends, as it is the job of some people to do, then Biden and people around him should probably be even more worried than I am.
Charlie?
Well, I'm a broken record on this in print and on this podcast, but I still do not understand why President Biden didn't come into office and say, I'm the adult in the room and I'm going to behave like it. We were clearly in a difficult spot back when Biden was inaugurated. We still had COVID. Inflation was on the horizon. We just spent $4-5 trillion we hadn't intended to, and that had caused a great leap in the debt and for a while our deficits. The situation was not rosy, and it was not unpredictable because it was predicted. I think some of us predicted it on this podcast. Certainly Kevin Hassett has been saying for a while, we're going to get double-digit inflation, we're going to get a recession. And we've done very little to mitigate it. There's a piece in Politico this morning, which essentially chronicles Biden's frustration with his inability to sell the public a optimistic view of the economy. Well, that's because there isn't one. Biden, it seems, wants to declare mission accomplished. He wants people to conflate the legislation that his party has passed with actual improvement on the ground. But they won't, because they're not the same thing. President Biden is not interested in the country he actually lives in. He's not interested in the issue that is affecting people the most, which is the high cost of goods and services that is now having knock-on effects, and the mitigation of it is having knock-on effects with high interest rates, with mortgage costs increasing, and potentially with a recession on the way. And I don't understand how somebody who claims to be good old Scranton Joe can be so obsessed with, you know, funneling trillions of dollars to college students or passing slush funds for the next Solyndras, when the real crisis is here on our doorstep. So it's going to be pretty bad for him, but it's going to be bad for him really of his own volition. I mean, yes, I'm with Jack. I'm the guy who says on this podcast and other podcasts and in my writing, let's not turn the president into a talisman. Let's not look at which economic trends have coincided with which president. Sometimes, rarely, government policy, you know, presidential policy can truly change or affect the economy. I think tax cuts in the early 1980s, for example, are a good example of that. And then there are pieces of legislation or executive actions that were taken to prevent bad things from happening. And we took some of those during the financial crisis of 2008. By and large, though, the president is not an emperor king. But presidents and congresses can make things worse. And inflation, although it is not Joe Biden's fault that we have some, has been made worse by congressional profligacy. And he's still doing it. And I just must count myself baffled. And he doesn't even seem to feel the need to play the Bill Clinton line and say, yes, I feel your pain. Yes, I understand this is happening. He's not even acknowledging the issue and distancing himself from it. On 60 Minutes the other night, he said, oh, it's just gone up a tiny bit. Yeah, from a pretty remarkable base. I don't think you can get away with it. There's a quote in this Politico piece I wrote about from James Carville saying, you can't pivot from the thing everyone is talking about. Well, actually, you can. You can. But you can't pivot from the thing everyone is talking about and expect to stay popular. And Biden has attempted to pivot from the thing everyone is talking about repeatedly. And that's why his approval rating is as low as it is, because he just doesn't look as if he's taking it seriously. And he doesn't look as if he's taking it seriously because he's not.
Jim Garrity, by the first half of next year, the U.S. will be in a bona fide recession. Now, journalists have often used two consecutive negative quarters as a rough measure of a recession. That was thrown out the window because a Democrat is in office when we've had two negative quarters. But also there have been some countervailing signs of strength in the economy. But it'll be a no doubt recession, unfortunately, by the first half of next year. Yes or no?
Yes, but you will get the same message from Biden and his Democratic allies that it's not really a real recession because, you know, it doesn't look like a post-apocalyptic Mad Max-like landscape.
Jack Butler.
Yeah, I agree with Jim. There'll be this sort of attempt to say this is a light recession in the same way that Biden said he may not act about a minor incursion by Russia into Ukraine.
Charlie Cook.
Yeah, we'll be in recession, and you just can't talk your way out of it. So if they try, they'll fail.
Yes, it'll be a recession. The Fed was too loose for too long, and now is going to have to really tighten up, slam the brakes. This is the reason why supply side policies are so desirable. They can fix the demand supply imbalance without harming people. In fact, while making the economy more productive, but those are nowhere in sight, obviously, under this administration. With that, let's hear from our third sponsor this episode, Segura. We know it can be difficult to make time for ourselves in this fast-paced world we live in. The stress of work, family, and the seemingly never-ending list of responsibilities we face every day are bound to take their toll. Take a step back and enjoy the finer things in life with Segura, the next generation of cigars online. Join Segura and be the first to see cutting-edge products, exclusive offers, and limited edition gear. Whether you're looking for top-shelf brands like Davidoff, industry staples like Fuente, or super rare blends like Viaje, Segura is your one-stop shop for all your cigar needs. Explore its curated selection of industry content that includes reviews, food and beverage pairings, beginner questions, and much more. Join the Segura Lounge and connect with fellow cigar enthusiasts alongside its staff, experts, and manufacturers, and be part of a one-of-a-kind cigar community. Give back to yourself. Visit Segura.com. That's Cigora.com. And use the checkout code REVIEW10. That's REVIEW10 to receive 10% off your first purchase. Segura, shop, connect, share. Again, check it out, segura.com, code REVIEW10. So Charlie Cook, we had this notable FBI raid. I think we can actually use that word, raid. There was a lot of debate whether that was the appropriate word for what happened at Mar-a-Lago, whether it was or not. That's what everyone has generally called it. But a pro-life activist who was wanted on a real desperado here on charges that he supposedly pushed down a pro-abortion activist outside an abortion clinic. The FBI SWAT team shows up, allegedly at his front door, guns drawn, freaks out everyone. His kids witness the whole thing, freak out his kids. And it's just hard to see how this is in any way proportionate to the alleged offense. What do you make of it?
I think the FBI is out of control. And I don't say that with any pleasure, but I have moved from the position that the FBI needs reform to the position that the FBI needs to be abolished in the last couple of years. And this is yet another example of it. I think that the idea behind the FBI is now so far out of touch with the reality of the FBI that we need to start again. And we're not talking here about an agency that is limited to enforcing federal law or that involves itself only when interstate commerce or crime is at stake. We're talking about an agency that has been essentially subsumed into Washington, D.C. and into our partisan battles. But worse than that, has been subsumed while people insist that it's independent. We apparently have a floating fourth branch of government in the United States that is answerable to nobody, not to the executive branch, not to Congress, not to the judiciary. And to that fourth branch belong the Department of Justice, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, the FBI, and others. So we have an FBI that is politicized, sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly. That is, sometimes because it has been given politicized orders, and sometimes because the people who work there are political. But nobody is held accountable for it. We don't get questions directly to the president about it, even though under its structure, the president is responsible for it. I have asked before, when evaluating the FBI and its behavior, what would happen in a similar circumstance? That was my question with Mar-a-Lago. Well, that's my question here as well. Is this standard operating procedure to send SWAT teams for this sort of alleged infraction? And if the answer is no, then what? Then what happens? Who resigns? Who's fired? When's the congressional hearing? This is a serious, serious infraction of public trust. And it baffles me how much attention we pay to similar infractions from, say, state police departments, which we should, but how little we pay to the FBI, and how many people are content to say, no, they're a terrific agency full of good patriotic people doing their duty. Well, if so, then they should be angered by this as well. Just do yourself a favor. Google right now FBI and just see how many bad stories come up from the last 2 weeks. It's not just this pro-life activist. Matt Gaetz in Florida. I'm no fan of his, but he seems to have been publicly smeared by the FBI. Cast your mind back to the Trump years and to Russiagate. Read the whistleblowers report last week. This is an agency that is out of control. And I profoundly hope that the next president is resolved to do something about it.
So Jim Garrity, with Matt Gaetz, a lot like the Russia hoax, you just had so much motivated walls are closing in type of coverage and commentary because people hate the guy. And it's not enough anymore just to hate someone, hope they lose elections. You want them nailed to the wall. And this was supposedly going to happen to Gaetz. Now that it hasn't happened, you know, a lot of people who were the walls closing in types will never mention it again. But the two witnesses against him and this case involving alleged sex trafficking, both a skeevy friend of his who's a genuine fraudster and guilty of all sorts of crimes, and one of the women involved are both apparently not reliable witnesses.
I am by nature and probably by inclination if not a fan of the FBI, then my instinct is to give them the benefit of the doubt, because I believe that most of the people who the FBI is hunting down and trying to bring to justice are genuine bad guys, drug dealers and gangs, terrorists, organized crime, et cetera, et cetera. When you start getting into white collar stuff and political stuff, it gets a little touchier. And I was struck by this exchange between Brett Stevens and Gail Collins of the New York Times. And I think Brett Stevens articulates this really well. Quote, "I'm upset by a longstanding pattern of incompetence tinged by what feels like political bias. I don't like Gaetz's politics or persona any more than you do. But what we seem to have here is a high-profile politician being convicted in the court of public opinion for some of the most heinous behavior imaginable, trafficking a minor for sex, until the Justice Department realizes 2 years later that its case has fallen apart. We have a presumption of innocence in this country because we tend to err the most when we assume the worst about people, the people that we like the least." Yeah, Matt Gaetz, where does Matt Gaetz go to get his reputation back? And again, I don't like the guy. I can't stand the guy in a lot of ways. I think it's everything I don't want in the modern Republican Party. But if the FBI or somebody in government's going to leak that he's involved in underage sex trafficking, well, you sure as hell better have the goods before you, you know. And if you can't, 2 years later, we can't prove it in a court of law. Whoopsie. Oh, well. I don't think the entire FBI is full of people like Peter Strzok. But I do believe that the institution is having potentially irreparable damage. And these cases are starting to pile up. Where you can't, it's getting tougher and tougher to believe, okay, it's one or two bad apples or one person who has a partisan axe to grind or something. Where is Dale Cooper when we need him?
So once again, the drilling and hammering only begins in earnest when Jim speaks on this podcast. With that, Jack, where are you on the FBI?
Well, I mean, jury's out on whether the FBI is the interference on Jim's feet. I don't know. But no, a couple weeks ago, I sort of said that when enough of these incidents of FBI malfeasance pile up, what's probably going to happen, assuming Republicans get at least one chamber of Congress back, is some kind of sort of right-wing church committee. And I recall at the time saying that I wasn't necessarily in favor of it, but something like it was probably going to happen. Now I'm kind of leaning toward, you know, I think something like that is necessary. There's just a clear record at this point of improper use of FBI resources and attention. And probably the most, one of the most insidious things, this raid on the pro-life activist is one of the most obvious incidences of malevolence that I can think of, just clear out of whack behavior. But one of the more insidious things is this manner of starting investigations and then just kind of having them hang out there unresolved with the apparent intent, and I can't prove this. I don't want to say that this is what is happening, but it just seems like the intended effect here is just to put a cloud over people that are politically unfavorable. And so long as this is the perception of the FBI, and so long as there is evidence that this is the direction that the FBI is tending toward, there is no reason to expect conservatives to like improve their trust of it as an institution. So basically, at this point, if the FBI wants to sort of save itself as a reputable means of law enforcement in this country, then it's going to have to either dramatically or drastically reform, or internally, or willingly subject itself to external pressure and external surveys of its behavior. And I don't see, like, I'm not sure if the former is going to happen. I mean, there just seems to be this intense and abiding pattern of misbehavior that has now persisted through two presidential administrations, but trending in the same direction. And that is a disturbing trajectory that, and it now seems that there's going to have to be some kind of external action by elected politicians against this if the trend is to be arrested in any way. Pardon the pun.
So, Charlie, what do you make of the argument someone could easily make? Well, look, you know, what are federal law enforcement authorities supposed to do when this guy Greenberg, who is an honest-to-goodness criminal and wasn't involved in abusive relationships with minors, says that Gates was in on it? Are they supposed to just sort of ignore it and it just goes away? Or do they need to investigate it? And investigations don't necessarily happen quickly. You got to run everything down, and it's not their fault that it was leaked. And in part, you had this crazy situation where Gates's father was being blackmailed by this guy who was promising a pardon for Gates. So there's some bizarre circumstances thrown in there too.
Well, I'd say a few things on that. First off, they shouldn't be announcing or leaking their investigations. What do you do if you're tipped off an allegation? You investigate it, fine. But we all know about it. As Jack says, this is a habit now. This is a trend. We seem to constantly be discussing people who are under FBI investigation. So one thing we can do, if we're not abolishing the FBI, is start imposing penalties for that sort of announcement or that sort of leak. And the second thing that we can do is insist that if the FBI either announces or leaks the name of somebody who's being investigated, and then that case falls apart, or the investigation reveals that there was nothing there in the first place, it says so. It goes out in front of the television cameras and it says, we have exhausted our investigation and we found nothing. I think it should be illegal for the FBI to insinuate that they believe that the person in question might be guilty, which is what they did with President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
That's what James Comey did. That was one of the most disgraceful, illiberal, un-American moments I've ever seen. And I say that, as our listeners know, quite aware of who Donald Trump is, quite aware that he is capable of committing crimes and may indeed have committed crimes. But if an investigatory organization spends time and money looking into somebody in the United States and does so publicly, if they have already, by virtue of their involvement, implied that the person might have done something wrong, then they should be obliged legally to go out and say, we found nothing. We could not find evidence. Because otherwise you're just doing it in one direction. I mean, I would rather the whole thing was silent, of course. But we can't have it only in one direction. We can't have a system in which people are dragged through the mud because of leaks or press conferences. And then when it comes to their... I mean it's under our system of presumption of innocence. But when it comes to their being let off the hook... We're just silent about it. No. So, you know, don't do it. And if you do it, then I want a press conference at which whoever it is. And you see, the whoever it is really matters, doesn't it? Because, and to his credit, Brett Stevens said this in the Times. There's such a a bind here, if you're an old school liberal, as I am, in that by definition, this is going to happen to people that you don't like more than to people you do. And so the human tendency, the visceral tendency, the almost medieval tendency is either to say, well, I don't care because it's Donald Trump or Matt Gaetz or whoever, or to preface your defense of them with some throat clearing, which is also another way of re-victimizing them. I mean, you watch the statements on this. Those on the left side of the political aisle who speak up against this, who won't be many in number, but those who do, will say, of course, I'm not a fan of Matt Gaetz. And then they'll list all of the things that are wrong with him. So, you know, you really don't want it to happen in the first place because, you know, once it does, there's actually no good way out of it for the person who's been targeted.
Jim Garrity, actually, a question to you. If Republicans take the House, they will hold hearings on the conduct of the FBI that will have some positive influence in how the FBI does its business. Yes or no?
Yes, on the margins. In that within the FBI, there'll be a recognition that they cannot give Republicans in Congress easy fodder to beat them about the head with it, so to speak.
Jack Butler.
I will say that yes, there will be hearings, and yes, they will produce some sort of good, I put good in quotes because there actually will be bad moments for our civic fabric, instances in which, you know, FBI higher-ups are squirrely or admit to wrongdoing without actually admitting to it. I'm not sure if actual reforms will result from them, though. It just may make everyone angrier, which will be a great outcome.
Charlie Cook.
No, I see. I think there's going to be a war of sorts. I don't mean a literal war, but I think there's going to be a political war here because my assumption is that the FBI is going to be recruited to try to bring down the next Republican president. I don't think that's a particular stretch. We saw it with the last one. And there will be enough people inside the FBI who will either be willing to go along with this or do it of their own volition. And so I don't expect that any attempts to reform the FBI are going to happen in a vacuum. I don't think that the next president's going to come in and say, one of the things on my agenda is to reform the FBI. I'll look forward to meeting with senators next Tuesday. I think that this will be a response. And of course, this will poison the well because it will then look defensive and we'll get all sorts of talk about corruption and so on in the fourth branch of government. So I think this is going to get pretty unpleasant before it gets better.
Well, I hope that our handlers at the CIA can take care of it.
So I think there will be hearings, obviously. I think they'll have some make some positive difference at the margins. I agree with Jim and really underline at the margins. But you'll have some holding of feet to the fire, which will have some good consequences. Not going to be transformative with that. Let me do a quick plug for NR Plus digital subscription service at nationalreview.com. Your way around our metered paywall. Your way. If you sign up and log in to see 90% fewer ads, especially those obnoxious ads that might be particularly distracting you when you're trying to read our content. Also, if you're a member, you can dig deeper into our community. You can comment on articles and blog posts. You can be part of our private Facebook group and be invited to exclusive calls and events with our writers and editors. We have a meetup coming up out on the West Coast while we're out there. If you're in the area and an NR Plus member, you will be getting an exclusive invitation. So it's a great deal all around, and we have great first-time rates for folks who haven't signed up yet. So hoping you will, if you haven't already, and join tens of thousands of your fellow National Review readers as a member of NR Plus. So let's hit a few other things before we go. Jack Butler, you've been digging Playing to Type into your Buckley anthologies.
That's right. I've got a couple here, the Governor Listeth and the Jeweler's Eye, and they're just such a joy to read. I mean, for one thing, they're time capsules. For another thing, I think that Buckley is perhaps underrated as a stylist. I know that's a ridiculous thing to say, but I think people, because his political achievements and movement achievements are so large and vast, people forget and don't really put him in the same sort of camp as other sort of mid-20th century pro stylists. And I think he belongs there. Just going back through some of these anthologies proves it.
Jim Garrity, also Playing to Type. You've been enjoying fall beers.
Yeah, as I get older, I'm trying to cut back. And there are certain times of year, it's a little bit easier than others. Spring tends to bring out the hoppier, you know, elderberry, you know, type ones, mm-hmm. summer ones. But fall is when you get two combinations that are among my favorites. The first are the dark beers, the stouts, the porters. Every brewery seems to come out with their own special one for this time of year. And winter is kind of when you like that strong flavor and heavy, and a, you know, really enjoyable one this past Friday night. Then Saturday night, we went out and they had on tap a pumpkin beer. And I know everything, you know, you can feel like this is kind of a ridiculous time of year where everything has pumpkin spice in it. Because Jack is here, I'll make the inevitable joke that, you know, from Dune, the pumpkin spice must flow. But this was a really good pumpkin beer. It wasn't too much, wasn't too strong. There are times when you can feel like you're getting waterboarded with pumpkin spice in some of these things. But it was just right. And this is going to be the time of year where I'm going to have a really my worst job of trying to avoid drinking more beer than I should on the weekends.
And Charlie, not Playing to Type, because this has been a rare event last couple of years, maybe unprecedented, a convincing Jaguar victory.
It was magnificent. I think I'm right in saying the Jaguars scored more points than any other team yesterday. So I suppose the Giants could supersede them tonight, but this is not usual. I'm watching this team and I'm thinking, as I said last time, well, this is what it feels like to watch an actual NFL team and not some joke that gets blown out every week. In fact, we were doing the blowing out. So they started 2-1. They really should be 3-0. They should have won their first game. I don't have unrealistic expectations. I understand that they're rebuilding, but yeah, they look good. The defense looked incredible. Lawrence looked really calm. The offensive line gave him some time. Their rookies are superb. And of course, the highlight was from James Robinson, who's undrafted with his, we needed 1 yard. It was 4th and 1 and he gave us 50 and ran into the end zone. So this was a fun Sunday in the Cook household.
So I finally resolved a ticklish DMV matter and got my license renewed. This was a long saga. Where I live, the DMV offices were not open during COVID. There were all sorts of special dispensations granted for expired licenses. You could fly on one for a year. I don't know whether that's been extended now, but I was looking at the end of that grace period, so I really had to get after this. And I used to live in New York. I never had a bad experience in a New York DMV, totally against type. You know, it's just efficient. You come in on a schedule and they get you out on schedule and they just help you. And this new state I've moved into, it was just a debacle. And partly my fault. My wife doesn't like my name to be on mail for doxing reasons, to try to avoid getting doxed again. So I had real trouble establishing my residency in this new state. Then once I thought I had the right documents, they said, no, wait a minute, you're making the wrong appointment because you're not just doing a license. You need to transfer an out-of-state license and renew. So this one lady just, I showed up and of course they don't say, well, you know, you made the wrong kind of appointment, but let's see what we can do. Not at all. And then it's just really hard to get the you have to transfer and renew appointment because supposedly it takes 45 minutes. So it could be months of waiting. I happened to get in after this problem, you know, like a week or two later. And now I'm really desperate. I got to make this work. I thought they were misreading the rules. They were vaguely written. I might have been overly insistent on my reading of the rules. But this one lady, I said, look, this is the state's rule. And she said, no, we're operating on my rules. And then I politely asked what her name was. She walked away. I politely asked what the name of the supervisor was when he came over. And then they politely asked me to be escorted from the facility. What? Then I realized I needed to make this appointment, which it takes months to do, in someplace else, because I literally did not trust these people not to sabotage me in some way. So last Friday, I drove an hour and a half to another DMV where everyone was actually nice and helpful. I had the stuff lined up and I finally have my driver's license renewed, saving me various embarrassments. But
so
finally got it
I
done.
Want to make a revision to what I said earlier about the FBI. So let's abolish the whole government everywhere, like every government there is. Are masks still required in the DMV that you went to, by the way?
No, they're not.
Okay. As of a couple months ago, they were still in DC. And just, I had a similar experience. And it's just, I mean, some DMVs, like those in Florida, Charlie alleges, are pleasant places.
They
and
are
sometimes,
pleasant places.
Yes, I know. Florida's great. We get it.
Yeah.
Some of them, and sometimes you have good experiences and even the bad ones, but sometimes it just, it's the closest approximation we get to just like experiencing communism. That's what I think.
It's the wielding of petty power. That
right. That's why. Yeah.
Crazy. If they're a little incompetent, slightly impatient and world weary dealing with the public all the time, fine. But being a petty tyrant is just really hard to take when they work for us. Anyway, it's that time of the podcast for our editor's picks. Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
A lot of strong options this week. I'm going to go with my co-panelist here, Charlie Cook, who's actually on his own hot streak lately. But he this morning, he really took apart a Politico piece. I kind of alluded to it at the end of today's Morning Jolt. Politico saying that, Biden's trying to get a chance to, he's finally got some good economic news. As we discussed earlier, it's not really that good. Why it's having a hard time getting credit for it. And, Charlie just takes a crowbar to this as it absolutely needs to. And he points out just a lot of wisdom just in one sentence here. One of the biggest challenges that Biden and his party now face is their near total inability to distinguish between their narrow ideological agenda and the health of the country at large. In that one sentence, that's a huge chunk of what is ailing the government in our country right now. Once again, good job, Charlie.
Thank you.
Jack Butler, what's your pick?
My editor's pick is Dan McLaughlin's take on the latest episode of The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, which he and I are both watching. Jim already referenced one of my nerdy passions, so I'll just double down on the other. I did not like the latest episode. Dan was more lenient about it, but with equal hesitation and reservation about where the show might be going. There's been good and bad in it so far. I'm willing to give it a chance, but if it blows it, it blows it. And I'm not going to be afraid to say so. And I don't think Dan will either.
Charlie Cook.
Well, my honorary pick is Dan's post on Creedence Clearwater Revival, which I thought was terrific and made me want to watch the documentary. But my actual pick, see how I stole a base there, is Tales of the Jazz Age and of Our Own by Michael Washburn from the magazines about F. Scott Fitzgerald and his enduring relevance. And the 100th anniversary of his collection Tales of the Jazz Age, the most famous part of which is the story, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. And Michael Washburn makes the case that Fitzgerald is a great deal more than just the author of The Great Gatsby. He was a great reader of people and chronicler of the human condition. And he is just as important a century on as he was.
It's a great book. It's a kind of a slight book, but just every page, there's a sentence or two that just completely dazzle. And I don't know whether I've said this on the podcast before, but I don't get Hemingway. I don't get why people like Hemingway at all. I mean, the prose seems just so pedestrian compared to Fitzgerald.
Can I just read you my favorite Fitzgerald quote, Rich?
Absolutely.
And I use it too much, I think, in pieces. But this shows that he had this capacity, not just for people, but for countries. He wrote, France was a land, England was a people, but America, having about it still that quality of the idea, was harder to utter. It was the graves at Shiloh and the tired, drawn, nervous faces of its great men and the country boys dying in the Argonne for a phrase that was empty before their bodies withered.
Mm.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, tremendous poetry. So my pick is a Matt Contineni piece from the magazine, The Woke and the Restless, about the problems Democrats have on cultural issues, because obviously their new upscale and blue city base is way out of whack with the public. And there was an illustration of this phenomenon out in Kansas, where there's a tight gubernatorial race, and the Democratic incumbent Laura Kelly last week had an ad where she says, you know what we all agree on? Men should not compete in girls' sports. Now that we all agree on that, let's talk about, you know, the funding of public education, when she'd vetoed twice bills to keep males from competing in girls' athletics. And she, the her opponent Schmidt, has just been hammering this issue and obviously forced her into this, but you know, she's someone who needs to appeal to a red state sensibility, so she can say something that, you know, the majority of people agree with, but most of her party wouldn't dare say. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National U podcast, and your rebroadcast, retransmission, or countless game without the express written permission of National U Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Jackie B. Thanks to NetChoice, Ball and Branch Sheets, and Segura. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.